We are here, and we're going to be looking at Acts 20 through 28 tonight. So put your roller skates on. I'm going to slide right through it. Actually, chapter 20 is the end, really, of the third journey, but it's different. It's an address of Paul to the elders of the church at Ephesus. And so in that sense, it's kind of standalone. And then in chapter 21, he gets to Jerusalem, and he's mobbed by the Jews at the end of chapter 21, coming out of the temple. The Romans rescue him, put him in jail. And so we start with a series of Paul's defenses for being who he was. We're not going to cover the one in chapter 22. Now, you can read these at your benefit or not. This is not a study in the book of Acts. But I'll tell you that in chapter 22, Paul stands on a balcony and he's addressing the Jews, the Romans who took him, arrested him, hoping to find some cause for why he was causing such a turmoil. Of course, he spoke to them in Hebrew, and I imagine the captain was educated enough in Hebrew that he could make it out, but he thought that Paul was somebody other than who he was. So that's chapter 22. And then in chapter 23, the Jews hatch a plot to kill him. So the commander sends him to Caesarea on the coast, Caesarea Maritima. There's also Caesarea Philippi, which is inland. But this is the one on the coast. Some people say Caesarea. A friend of mine was over there on a tour and wanted to see Caesarea. And the guide said, Caesarea. Ah, Caesarea. So he is named after Caesar, right? Caesarea. So chapter 23, he sent to Caesarea. Then in 24, he makes his defense before the governor, Felix. We'll take a look at some of that. Then in chapter 25, by Jewish machinations, he is forced to appeal to have his case heard by Caesar. Once he does that, he has to go to Caesar. And so that's what chapter 27 and 28 are all about, his journey to see Caesar. So we're not going to talk about chapter 25 at all, but then in chapter 26, the governor is at a loss of, what charge do I send to my lord, the Caesar? What charge do I send? So King Agrippa came visiting, and the two of them invited Paul to make his defense before them because they want to write something down. So we're going to look at chapter 26 in a little more detail also. 24 and 26, defense before Felix, then defense before King Agrippa. And then we'll take a look at 27 and 28. 27 is the voyage, the sea ship, the sea voyage from Caesarea to Rome, rather adventurous sea. And then in chapter 28, he makes his presentation to the Jewish leadership in Rome. And they have a few things to say about that. But first of all, I want to look here at chapter 20, where Paul is. It's a farewell address, really. It's a farewell address to the elders at Ephesus. Now, he's meeting them on a coastal city. He's asking them to come out to the, so he doesn't have to hold up the ship or rush. And whenever the ship leaves, he can get on and they can walk on back. So he's asked them to come out to Mytilene, or Miletus, actually. In verse 17, he was at Miletus, which is on the coast of what we call Turkey, Asia Minor, kind of halfway down the coast on the far western side of it, and is sent to Ephesus and asked for the elders to come to him. And he said, midway through verse 18, "You yourselves know from the first day that I set foot in Asia how I was with you the whole time, serving the Lord with all humility, and with tears, and with trials which came upon me through the plots of the Jews, how I did not shrink from declaring to you anything that was profitable, and teaching you publicly and from house to house, solemnly testifying to both Jews and Greeks of repentance toward God and faith in our Lord Jesus Christ. I'll stop the reading there and get your impressions. I'm going to do this from time to time. Just stop reading and ask you what you saw. Now, we're paying a special attention to what made Paul so effective in leading people to Jesus. What can you determine about his character? What can you determine about his heart? That you say, well, that.
Yeah, humility and he should.
What's humility? What is humility?
Humility.
What is humility?
Humbleness.
What kind of man was Paul? I mean, think about education. What kind of man was he?
He wasn't very educated.
Pardon?
He was very educated. Yeah.
Highly educated. He sat at the feet of Gamaliel. Very, very few Jewish people were able to sit at someone so highly esteemed as him. Very well educated. You read his letters, and you say he was very articulate. Luke and Paul are really challenging to translate. John is a piece of cake because John used very simple fisherman language. Paul and Luke used very sophisticated grammatical constructions. Challenging. So he's a very, very well-educated man. Okay? And so humility. And he's not flaunting his education. Why not? Why not? Think through this.
The thought just occurred to me. He was confident in Jesus.
Okay.
And
okay.
He was confident to the point that he didn't shrink from proclaiming Christ. Well, now it says profitable, but
anything that was profitable.
Yeah.
Okay. But I want to stay on this humility thing.
I think that he knew that even with all of his knowledge before, he was still wrong. And now he's still the same person. It's just that he's been led to the right path, and it's not through his own knowledge.
Okay, and that's good. Go ahead.
What I was going to say is he was so humble. He said, I'm not only a sinner, I'm the chief of sinners.
Right.
It's like he owned up to being like,
He did.
He just like, I'm like the worst of the worst.
Let me throw out a thought. Let me throw out a thought. To whom is Paul wanting to convert the people?
Jesus.
He doesn't want them to be followers of him. He wants them to be followers of Jesus. So it's not, look at the big name preacher. Look at all the degrees and the titles that I have strung out and all the accolades men have given me. I only want you to follow Jesus, not follow me. And so humility, I'm just a servant like you. Reminds me of the angels in the book of Revelation when John fell down at the feet. And they said, don't do that. I'm a fellow servant just like you. And so humility, that's a very strong what I'm trying to say is it's a very powerful way to make sure that people are following the right message. Not following me because I'm eloquent, following God because the message resonates with my heart. Yeah, so Paul got out of the way of his message.
I don't know if this makes any sense. This is kind of my life story. I've seen a lot of movies. I've listened to a lot of music. I admire a lot of people in the entertainment industry and their abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only met, like, in person. I've been to concerts, but I've been at a distance, on the nosebleeds. Okay, so I would be kind of starstruck if Robert De Niro walked in here right now.
He'd be star. Oh. Anyway, let's
I'm just letting you know.
Yeah, let's move on, thinking that this is a quality that made Paul effective, that he was leading people to Christ, not to Paul. We're going to see that as we go on more. So he says, tears. Why was Paul a ball baby? Why was he crying?
He was so passionate
About.
About his cause and about Jesus.
And
about saving and people that leaving, were lost.
Leaving. Louder, Michael.
He was going to be leaving them. He was the sorrow of the bond, the bonds.
But that's not what these tears are. He says, I was with you. You remember how I was with you in tears. So this was not his departure. This was his being there with them. Somewhere we'll find, when we get there in his letters, who is not led to sin and I don't burn. Paul took the well-being of everybody he was with into his heart. And when they hurt, he hurt. And so the tears would be crying over somebody's broken heart, or crying over somebody's lost loved one, or crying over somebody's lost faith. Paul cared about the people. Paul cared about the people. That's what made him effective. And then he says, also here in verse 18, with the trials which came upon me. Now, this is not a trial like a legal trial. This would be the challenges, the trials and tribulations, as it were, that came because of the obstacles that the Jews were placed before him. Now, there may have been some legal trials, but I think Paul is talking about more than just the opposition that came upon me because of the Jews, and I did not shrink. Now, I'm disappointed that the Bible has verse 19 separated from verse 20, because I think the did not shrink is genuinely connected with the trials. I could keep myself from being persecuted by the Jews if I didn't fully talk about Jesus. So he did, but I'm not going to let the opposition keep me from telling what you need to hear. You see that? To keep me from telling what you need to hear. Okay, anything else in that reading?
Also, just kind of also points towards his devotion to it, that, as you know from the first day, day that I set foot in Asia, it's not just that he was humble and that he cared about the people that he was ministering to, but that his devotion was there from day one, he didn't stray away from it.
Now, that's a really good point. Look also, and think about the ramifications of this in verse 20, declaring to you everything that was profitable, teaching you publicly and from house to house. Think about the ramifications of that. What I did Sunday morning right here? I made a public declaration. Okay? I post my podcast every Monday. I'm making a public declaration. And so a lot of people, or a few people, depending upon the size of the audience, but the public is this a broad spread. But house to house, that might be individual to individual, and a lot more demanding of Paul's time. ROI is?
Mm-hmm. Return on interest.
Or on investment.
Investment, yeah.
Return on investment. So I invest this much time. I invest an hour, and there's 50 people in the audience. I invest an hour, and there's two. Okay, it didn't matter to Paul the size of the audience. It mattered to Paul to declare what was profitable, even if it was just a one-on-one. And sometimes the one-on-one is actually more effective. Okay? In verse 26, I'm going to start in 25. And now, behold, I know that you all, among whom I went about preaching the kingdom, will see my face no more. I know that. Therefore, I testify to you this day that I am innocent of the blood of all men. For I did not shrink from declaring to you the entire testimony of God. Now, remember who to whom he's speaking and who he is encouraging. It's the elders, the leaders of the family that he'll never see again. And it's like he's leaving them with this exhortation. Here's how I did it. Well, why is he telling them, here's how I did it?
So they can do it.
So they can do it. Be the example. This is how you get it done. Okay. But look there, Alan. 26. I'm innocent of the blood of all men. You might just go to say Ezekiel chapter 3, chapter 33, and see where God says, you know, if I tell you to tell them that a storm is coming, and you don't tell them the storm is going to come, but their blood will be on your head. But if you tell them that there's a storm coming and they ignore you, they're going to die in the storm, but you rescued yourself. There's a certain level of expectation of these people get to make the decision, and I'm going to give them that opportunity. Therefore, I'm going to be clear, free from the blood. Yeah.
You want me to read Ezekiel 3:23?
No, I don't. Oh, okay. I don't. I just wanted you to know that it was there, that that's the basis behind this. We really have to cover some ground, like I said, put our roller skates on. In verse 31, he says, therefore, be on the alert, remembering that night and day for a period of 3 years, I did not to cease to admonish each one with tears. You can't be living. You've got to change it. You got to do it. And crying over their maybe not quite getting it or not quite implementing it. This is where you need to be. He cared about people. That's the point. He cared about people. Yeah, Tom.
Admonish is like minister or...
I admonish, the Greek word means to put in mind. Put in mind.
Okay.
Sometimes it's translated warn.
Warn.
But it means to put it in your mind. I want to speak in such a way that it gets into your mind, not just bounce off your ear bones. Okay? And so, 33... I have coveted no one's silver or gold or clothes. You yourselves know that these hands minister to my needs and to the men who are with me. In everything, I showed you that by working hard in this manner, you must help the weak and remember the words of the Lord Jesus that he himself said is more blessed to give than to receive. I knew a man one time. I know of a man. I knew the man. I didn't hear him say this, but I was... It was reported to me. You don't need to know his name. It doesn't matter. But he lost his job. Couldn't find a job. He says, well, maybe I could be an elder and get paid. See, to him, it was a matter of making money. To Paul, he says, if I have to work with my hands to help these guys that are with me, I'll do it. Because he had the skills. But mainly, I just want to preach the gospel. I don't want your money. Just want to preach. And so, I fear sometimes for preachers who demand a big salary and all the perks that go with it. It looks to me like it's more like an occupation than a passion. It's here's a job I can settle into rather than there's people out there that need me. And that Paul was, there's people out there that need me. In verse 35, he says, in everything, well, we read that, I showed you, I demonstrated through my life that it's not the money, it's the people that you're concerned about. Okay. Chapter 20, any thoughts on his address here? There's a lot of stuff here that we've just passed over because we're mainly focusing on what was it about Paul that we can detect? What was he like and what was driving him and what was important to him and what didn't matter to him? And, you know, I think it's really, really powerful. He said in First Corinthians 11, verse 1, be imitators of me as I also of Christ. It's really important that we see who he was. Any thoughts? Okay, like I said, chapter 21 is just Paul arriving in Jerusalem, finishing the mission, the third journey, being accosted by the Jews while he's offering sacrifices in the temple, and then being arrested by the Romans to rescue him, actually, from being pulled apart by the Jews. In chapter 22, Paul stands on the balcony and makes his address to the Jews. We looked at that in pieces when we talked about his conversion. In chapter 22, Paul is explaining to these people why he was, what he was. He got all the way down to about verse 21. He says, and God said, I will send you far away to the Gentiles. And as soon as he said God would send me to the Gentiles, the Jews there quit listening and started fomenting a riot again. How dare you say God would be concerned about the Gentiles? Anyway, that's when the Romans came in and rescued. They rescued him once again. And here now they just grabbed him and took him and put him into jail and brought the Jewish council together. Chapter 23, Paul is addressing the council. That's where he said in verse 1, I have lived with a perfectly good conscience before God until this day. The high priest ordered him to be, slap that man's mouth, say something like that. They're very hostile, very enraged at Paul at this point. And Paul looked at the audience and he realized he's not getting a fair hearing. Have you ever seen a situation like that? You know, it doesn't matter what you say. You know, you're not going to be heard. They've already got set in their mind what they're going to do. You can't reason with people who are heated up emotionally. So Paul stood up and said, I'm a Pharisee, I'm a son of a Pharisee, and I'm on trial for the hope and the resurrection of the dead. And at that time, the Pharisees, oh, that's a pretty good thing to say. And the Sadducees, no, it's not. And they started fighting with each other. The Romans thought Paul might be torn apart. So they came in and rescued him again. And it was at this point, while he's in jail, that the Jews got 40 men got together and made a pact between them that we won't eat or drink until we kill that man. Paul's nephew overheard it and went and told Paul. Paul called the jailer and said, take this man to the commander, and he did. And that with that, the commander put together 200 footmen and 70 horsemen, we're going to take Paul to Caesarea and keep him there. He'll be safe then from the Jews. And once they got him there, that's when they invited the Jews to come to Caesarea and make their case. And that's chapter 24. So here in chapter 24, the Jews hired a man, Tertullus, and a lawyer, and he started presenting his case before Felix. And then, it is. Where did I see Felix? I thought I saw Felix.
Verse 3.
Yeah, most excellent. Thank you. He is addressing Felix. And then, look at verse 9. So Tertullus finished his speech in verse 8, if you examine him, you'll see everything I said was true. And at that time, verse 9, all the Jews joined in the attack, asserting that that's right, that's what he did. He just kept that up. And so Felix looked at Paul and says, you can speak now. And so he did. Now, I'm not going to look at a lot of this, but look at verses 14 through 16. He says, up in 13, they can't prove any of the charges that they can't prove them. There's no proof. All right. But I will admit this to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets. So I'm not deviating one whit from the baseline of their belief. Having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves, that there shall certainly be there is about to be, that shall certainly is literally about to be, there is about to be a resurrection both of the righteous and the wicked. In view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience before God and before men. So what do you see in that? What is it? What characteristics or qualities do you find in there that say, man, I want to be like Paul right there?
Yeah. Steadfast.
Integrity.
Steadfast, integrity. Mm-hmm.
He just stuck to his gun, so to speak.
Now, but you see, now he did.
He runs back to
that. No, he did. But Tom, really, the question is, what motivated him to do that? See, that's the piece we're at.
And the hope of salvation.
I don't want to go into
thinking,
all the...
I was thinking of just his love for the people.
Okay.
All his love, God's love.
I don't want to go into Paul's theology here. But the hope was a hope that all the Jewish believers, or all the Jews up to the time of this, held because of what was in the law and the prophets. There was a hope of something that God was going to do for this people. And Paul said, I'm just being true to that. I'm just being true to that. It's a hope that they cherish. And so I'm not adversarial to them. They just don't like where I have taken what that hope looks like. It looks like Jesus. And they didn't like that. So,
right. They were the ones that...
But the point I'm really getting at is that Paul's passion, his message, was centered on, based on, founded on what he found in the law and the prophets, what he found in God's word. Never, and I repeat this with all passion, never separate the new and the old. So, Rachel, I'm going to ask you a question. You got your favorite flowering bush. Maybe it's a rose or something. Okay? And it's got a blossom on it. And you cut the blossom off to take it to the house. Does it last as long or not as the blossoms you leave on the tree?
It doesn't.
It fades. It withers. And connecting the message of the New Testament from the stem of the Old Testament is going to cause it to fade and wither. You've got to keep them connected. And so Paul says, what I'm presenting is in fact what the law and the prophets said would be. And so I'm just passionate about that. I'm passionate about that. If you want to understand the New Testament, you've got to understand the Old. Because there's a lot of ways that you can get sideways with the new if you don't understand the terminology. We've already seen some of them in our Isaiah study. Coming on a cloud. Well, what does that mean? You know, it means the dust storm of an invading army is what it means. But how many people with just the New Testament would draw that conclusion?
Right. Right.
And so Paul's message was rooted in the entire message of God, not just in the letters, the story of Jesus. And the letter. And I hate to say it that way, not just in the story of Jesus, because the story of Jesus is the story of the Bible. It's everything that Adam looked for, and Moses and David is what they looked for. Now, we look back at faith, in faith at what God did, and they look forward in faith what God was going to do, and we all look at the cross. So I'm not diminishing that. I'm saying separating the law and the prophets from your presentation of Jesus, you're going to get a faded rose. Okay? I didn't mean to go that far into that, but there you go. Now, after several years, I came. Paul's explaining what took place in the temple, actually, and we'll skip over that. And Felix just wanted money, kept him in custody. Verse 23, gave him some freedom, didn't prevent any friends from coming to him, but kept him there, wishing maybe to get some money from the people, bail money or bribe money to get Paul out. Nobody would pay it. So in verse 24, some days later, Felix arrived with Drusilla, his wife, who was a Jewess, and sent for Paul and heard him about faith in Jesus, in Christ Jesus. Now, this is not a trial or presentations. I want to hear about this faith thing. And as he was discussing righteousness, self-control, and the impending judgment, Felix became frightened and said, "Go, go, go! When I find time, I'll summon you." The message scared him, and but at the same time that he was hoping that money would be given him by Paul, therefore he'd send him for him often. But notice what Paul did. I this guy who got me in prison, I'm not going to butter him up. I'm going to tell him this is the right way to live. But notice, not just the right way to live, but the self-control to live that right way and the impending judgment.
Oh,
It's,
I found a spot. Sorry.
okay. It's kind of like, how do I want to say this? Noah built this ark, and the flood water is rising, and say, "You want to be saved getting this ark?" Well, yeah, I see that's what I ought to do, but man, I sure like swimming out here with the sharks. And Felix never would make the decision. Self-control, right? Self-righteousness. Here's where you ought to be living, Felix. That probably would include giving up some stuff and treating people differently. He was in power, a position of power that would include the kind of sentences he would. And you notice here in verse 26, he was hoping money. He was willing to take a bribe. That he was willing to take a bribe. Paul wasn't willing to give him a bribe, but he's willing to talk to him about, that's wrong, don't you? I mean, the guy that's got you in prison, and Paul's saying, that's wrong, and you need to be in control of yourself because God is about to judge this place. I mean, he cared about Felix enough to tell him to do the right thing, even though it kept him a whole lot longer. Tom, did you have luck? Well, don't manufacture one. If it's right there on the top of your head.
It's not there.
Okay.
I
All
was
right.
focusing on verse 26.
Yeah. So any further thing that you want to bring out about this defense before Felix? Now, I'm wanting you to get the sense of who Paul was, not just what he did, but deeper, why would he do that? And what did he hope to accomplish? And what were his passion points? What were his "I would rather die than give this up" point? See, you know what I'm saying? I'd rather give up my life than give up this belief or this practice.
There's that Bible text that says there's no greater love than for, it says a man, but I think it means everybody, to lay down their life for their friends or even and love your enemies too.
Yeah.
Rod.
No greater love is any man than this, and he would lay down his life for his friends. Jesus said, "I'm calling you friends," because he was about to lay down his life. The next morning, he would lay down his life. Okay,
Rod.
moving on. In chapter 25, then shenanigans again, Jewish shenanigans, and Felix is willing to go along with them. Said, "Well, we didn't get we didn't get any satisfaction here at the district court or the." I'm trying to. Caesarea was the center of the court of his ruling. Jerusalem would be like a lesser court. He said, "Will you go down to Jerusalem and stand before me there?" Of course, Paul knew it goes down to Jerusalem. There's going to be a lynch mob, and he'd never get a trial. He'd just be taken out and stoned to death. And that's when Paul then appealed to Caesar. And Jews couldn't do anything about that. Verse 10 of 25, Paul said, "I am standing before Caesar's tribunal," right there in Caesarea, "where I ought to be tried. I have done no wrong to the Jews, as you very well know. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I don't refuse to die. But if none of these things it is, of which these men accuse me, no one can hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar. I want, Paul is essentially saying, Felix, you are inadequate and incapable, or whoever it was, I think it was a new guy took over, not Felix anymore. Festus, yeah, Festus succeeded Felix. And this is where I'm supposed to be tried. And if you're incapable, it's almost like that. Mm-hmm. If you're incompetent and incapable of passing judgment here, of course, all he's trying to do is do the Jews a favor, keep peace in the area. And that was a very volatile area. And, it's kind of like the anti-ICE crew. Anything to torture. We want to try to keep peace. And so would you go down there and be tried? I don't belong down there. I belong right here, as you very well know. And I've done nothing wrong, as you very well know. If I'm worthy of death, I don't refuse to die.
Right.
But none of these things are true. So I appeal to Caesar, which means once, as a Roman citizen, once he appealed to Caesar, he had to stand before Caesar, however long it took. And Paul will be on ice for a couple of years before he even gets an opportunity once he gets to Rome. But that's where this is. Now, notice what he said here. I have done no wrong to the Jews, verse 10, as you also very well know. I've done nothing wrong. So we're going to go to Caesar. Rachel, put yourself in the position of being the one writing to my Lord Caesar why I'm sending you this man. And you've been incapable of determining that he's guilty of anything. But you got to write to your Lord Caesar. Here's why I'm loading up your workload with this guy. Mm-hmm. So that's what chapter 26 is all about. Verse 27 of 25, last verse of 25. It seems absurd to me in sending a prisoner not to indicate also the charges against him. I don't know what to write to my Lord. I'm sending a prisoner, but I have no idea what to charge him with. And that was Festus to Agrippa. Agrippa says, well, here. And he says, well, you're going to get to hear it. And so that's chapter 26. Now, Paul is to make a presentation to Agrippa of why he's where he is. And so he's going to go through his conversion story again. We're not going to go through that conversion story. Verse 1 says, you are permitted to speak for yourself. So this is not a question answer like the prosecutor asked a question. Just tell me your story. And so he did, and we looked at the story before, but I want to drop down to verse 16. Here's where he's laying on the ground on the road to Damascus. He's hearing, he heard the voice and saw the great light. And he said, verse 15, who are you, Lord? And I'm Jesus whom you're persecuting. But now arise, stand on your feet. For this purpose I have appeared to you, to appoint you a minister and a witness, not only to the things which you have seen, but also to the things in which I will appear to you. So Paul is going to have appearances from Jesus. He spent 3 years in Asia after he got out of Damascus, Arabia, I said Asia, 3 years in Arabia before he came back to Jerusalem. What he was doing out there, we don't know. It's not recorded. Maybe that's where Jesus appeared to him. But we know several times in the story that Jesus has appeared to Paul. You're going to be my witness, not only what brought you to me, but in the other things that I'm going to appear to you in. In 2 Corinthians, I think it's chapter 12, Paul says, I had a vision in which I saw paradise. I can't tell you what I saw. I was prohibited from that, but I saw it. So there was interaction between Paul and God, Paul and Jesus, after his conversion. But he said, you're going to be a witness, not only to the things which you have seen, but also to the things in which I will appear to you, delivering you from the people, that'd be the Jewish people, and from the Gentiles to whom I'm sending you. Delivering you. See, implies what? Well, Paul here is that God has said, you're going to go preach to the Gentiles, and I will be delivering you from them. What did I tell you?
They got him. They captured him at some point.
They made life difficult for Paul, didn't they? I'm not going to do it here. Maybe when we get into the section where we look at the Corinthian letters, but I'll just give it to you now to read 2 Corinthians 11. Just read it and see what Paul faced. Okay, here it is. You're going to suffer, and then see what he faced. All right, and then ask yourself the question: why did he do that? Delivering you from the people and from the Gentiles to whom I'm sending you, to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light, and from the dominion of Satan to God, in order that they may receive forgiveness of sins. You look out at our world today, Alan, and tell me, the people who are doing what they're doing in opposing the ICE officers, why are they doing that? What's motivating them? There is blatant lawlessness. Now, you may or may not agree with the function that they have been commanded to do, but they've got legitimate commands to do it. They're law enforcement. And what does God say about our relationship to law enforcement? And so they're in the dark. They don't know how to make wise, enlightened decisions about things. And here's Paul. You get to go talk to people who are in the dark so you can open their eyes to see the light. Yeah, let them suffer. They're in the dark. They chose to be there. They're just idiots. You're going to go show people how to see things through the eyes of God. What a blessing that is. I mean, if you have enjoyed the blessing of seeing your world through God's eyes, then helping other people see is going to be a blessing as well. So I'm going to ask Tom, you're in a wheelchair, so I can't ask you this. So I ask Alan instead. So you're walking through the woods, and there's on a path, but there's rocks and roots and limbs. Would you rather do it in the light of day or in the dark of night?
Maybe day would probably be good
unless you had one of those high powered flashlights, right?
Yeah.
You want to see where you're stepping. You want to see the things in your way. Spiritual life is exactly the same. Paul was told to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness. Now that's as altruistic as you can get. To turn from the dominion. What dominion? What's dominion?
World. Realm.
Domain.
The rule dominion. Of a king. The rule of a king.
Ruler over the people in the domain. See, to exercise dominion, to exercise tyranny, whatever. The dominion of Satan to God. Yeah, Tom.
What is the definition of altruistic?
Oh, I don't know. I don't either. I think it has to do with making decisions that are right just because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I was thinking it was like when I just sort of think about it and kind of meditate on the like truth, that's kind of meditate on things that are maybe.
No, it's not meditating. It's action. Doing the things because they're the right thing to do.
Right.
Whether or not they're the thing that appeals to you.
Right.
So, in order that they may receive forgiveness and an inheritance among those who've been sanctified by faith in me. I want you to go out there, Paul, and help people find me. Consequently, King Agrippa, I did not prove disobedient to the heavenly vision. This is what God wanted me to do. That's what I want to do. I know that's simplistic. This is what God wanted me to do, so that's what I want to do. But that testifies, doesn't it, to how he's connected to God's heart and not just what he would like to do with his life. Okay? So there it is. Verse 25, he says, no, why did I have 25 down there? Oh, that's that other place. That's back in chapter 24, 27 through 29. Paul says, he's talking. Festus says, Paul, you just out of your mind. You talking about God raising from the dead. And Paul says, verse 25, I am not out of my mind. Most excellent Festus. Notice how he's so respectful. Okay. Most excellent Festus, I'm not out of my mind. But I utter words of sober truth. This is the truth. You know, one of the arguments for, I don't call it an argument, an explanation. Why did Paul make such a radical shift? Going up to Damascus to intensify his persecution against Christians. But when he gets there, he's making Christians. I mean, that's a one-day turnaround. That's unheard of to be going 60 miles an hour in that direction and then instantly 60 miles an hour in the other direction. Boom, like that. And so one of the explanations is proffered is, well, Paul just went crazy. You know, crazy people do crazy things. There's your explanation. Have you ever read the book of Romans? There is not one whit of crazy in that book. It's so intricate, and the logic is so precise and intricate. That's not the rantings of a crazy man. So Paul didn't, but Festus says, you're crazy! Paul says, I'm not. I'm uttering words of sober truth. Get you a minute. I'm uttering words of sober truth. That knows about these things. I mean, he knows. He has seen my life. And he knows that I'm telling the truth. And I'm persuaded that none of these things escape his notice. For he has not been done in a court. And then Paul turned and looked right at Agrippa. He says, do you believe the law and the prophets? Because I know you believe. And Agrippa says to him, with this little bit, will you persuade me to become a Christian? I don't think that's him saying, I'm almost persuaded. Think, are you going to persuade me with just this? And Paul says, I would to God, whether you're in a short, or with a little, or with much, not only you, but everybody else in this room would be like me, except for the genes. What's Paul doing there? I'm going to get your question in a minute, Tom, but I wanted to develop this thought first. What is Paul doing with that? What do you see in Paul?
He's reasoning with him.
Okay.
I mean, he's being patient, taking time, and enduring the.
I don't care about my chain, and I don't want you to have a chain, but I want you to be like me.
Right.
And he's not just doing Festus and Agrippa. Everybody, you've all heard what I've said. I wish that you all be like me, because verse 18, turn your eyes from darkness to light so you can repent and be forgiven by God. I want you to be like me. Paul was not intimidated by the audience. He wasn't intimidated by the circumstances. The only thing he wanted was for them to be like him. He was driven by the passion that people need Jesus. Now, if you want to write that down somewhere, you might hear me say it from time to time. People need Jesus. And Paul was driven by that. I know they need Jesus.
There's a beautiful song. People need the Lord.
Yeah.
People need.
So what was your question?
Well, it was a statement about when you're talking about how Paul could be going 60 miles an hour in this direction. Goes 60
yeah.
miles. And that was on the road to Damascus when Jesus met him, and it was his divine miracle of putting the blinders over his eyes. I think that, you know, to be was he blind like 3 days or something like that?
Yeah.
And then he had time to think.
We
in
saw
that blindness.
Yeah, we saw in our class on the second class conversion of Paul that Paul was doing what for those 3 days? He wasn't eating and drinking, but what was he doing?
Praying.
Praying. He was praying and having visions. He saw Ananias come to him and heal him. So I was going somewhere with that. The person of Paul shows up. You can see the choices he's making, the things that are important to him, those things that matter to him. I don't care what people think of. I wish I could get there, because I'm still intimidated by what people might, if I say what I'm, no, they need to hear. I'm still intimidated by that. Not as near as much as they used to be. But here's Paul. He didn't care. Alan, I wish I had done this step, this one that I'm doing here about profiling Paul. I wish I'd done this 20 years ago, 30 years ago, just to get a sense of what it's like to be a servant of God. And I'll never be the goat, but I would have been better than I am now had I done. I truly believe that. Not that I'm saying I'm good. It's just I would have more Paul's quality and characteristics if I had done that earlier. Now, not going to get into the shipwreck, other and the presentation in Acts 20. Those are good things, but there's one thing I want to, just one thing. So, out on a ship sailing to Rome, and they get foolishly caught in a nor'easter, just blows them out, headed toward, you know what the Syrtis is? Ever heard of the Syrtis? It's still there today. It's this massive, miles long, shallow, sandy shore on the north coast of Africa. And a shallow, sandy shore that extends out for miles, easy to run aground, miles away from shore, miles away from land, in sharkened water. Syrtis was dreaded by the sailors. And this wind, this nor'easter, is blowing them right toward the surface. And so they're just, everybody. There's sailors, and there's prisoners, and there's soldiers. There are 200 people on this ship. And they haven't seen the stars or the sun or the moon for 2 weeks because of the, and you know, today that's no big deal because we got electronic stuff. But then they had compass and sextant, and that's how they guided their ship. They couldn't see the stars, had no idea where they were. And Paul had warned them about, you know, it's too late in the season to sail. We need to stay here. But anyway, soldier wanted to get them home. They sailed, they suffered damage, and Paul said, verse 21, men, you ought to have followed my advice. I'm halfway through the verse. You ought to have followed my advice and not sail from Crete and incurred this damage and loss. Now, by this time, they chucked over all the extra rigging, over the everything that they could afford to chuck over, and they ultimately ended up throwing the cargo overboard. Yeah. Total loss. In fact, the ship wrecked and everything's lost. But he says in verse 20, now I urge you to keep up your courage for this loss of life among you, only of the ship. You're all going to live through this. Not going to be a ship left, no cargo, nothing, but you'll have your lives. For this very night, an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I stood before me, whom I served before me, saying, don't be afraid, Paul. You must stand before sea. And behold, God has granted you all these who are sailing with you. Now, what do you make out of that? There's a couple things. Verse 23, the God to whom I belong. I'm his and whom I serve. There's this relationship between Paul and God. Him and I serve him. And I think that's part of what made Paul so good, that he had that sense, I belong to God. He's got me in his hand. He's got everything I'm going. I have nothing to fear. John 4:18, perfect love casts out fear. I have nothing to fear because I love God. He loves me. And this is what I'm doing. Okay. And Tom, you had a thought.
Encourage all the people.
Yeah. They were just very hurt his heart. They thought, Robert, ship's gonna not be left. Have ship left, but every my God said every one of you is gonna make it. And that was good enough for Paul. But he also says that God has granted you all those who are sailing with you. God has granted you them. What does that tell you? What do you think, Rachel? God has granted you these people. I couldn't prove it.
You had a relationship with God.
He did. Yeah. Okay. They didn't. Why did God say, I did you all these people? My theory is Paul then prayed for them.
That's what I was going to say. He prayed for them.
Prayed for them to arrive safely. Whether or not they embraced to live through this experience, and God granted me you. See? God granted me you. I hope that you're impressed with the qualities of Paul. The steadfastness, I think that's the term that Tom uses, steadfastness, the loyalty, the devotion. I hope you get a sense of how he built his entire ministry on what God said. This wasn't about building a church. It wasn't about bringing more people in. Well, and when people get that notion, they start doing things that Paul didn't do because we're trying to attract people not to Jesus, but to the fringes and the hills and the entertainment or whatever it is. But Paul preached Jesus, and he wept with people, and he cried with people, and he served people rather than having them serve him. And he was rooted to the message of God and devoted to the God of the message. Well, that's enough for tonight. I want to say quickly, there were four possible, and I meant to do this at the time we did the conversion of Paul, and he ran out of time. And we're almost at a full hour now. So I'm going to cheat, and you're going to sit there or leave, whichever you choose. But what caused the abrupt that if it were a freight train going 60 miles an hour, it'd take it a full mile to stop, just to stop, and then it'd have to start chugging backward, or a big long loop of track to be going in the other direction. Paul just went the other direction immediately. What can account for that? Well, Paul, you're out of your mind. That's one explanation. Another one is, somebody set up an elaborate scheme to trick Paul. Okay? Now, I can imagine an elaborate scheme at this point in our technology where a light could be brighter than the noonday sun and a sound appear. Maybe we've got the technology to do that. Did they have it? Okay. And then you're also faced with the question, who would want to trick Paul? The Christians wouldn't do it because they'd rather die than sacrifice their faith. Romans didn't care. Jews wanted Paul doing exactly what he was doing. Who was there to perpetrate the trick? All right, that's number two. Number three, Paul purposely did this to gain access, to find more of them rascal Christians. He purposely did it to gain access. Okay, let's test that one out. What was the rest of his history like? He gave up status. I was, he said in Philippians, I was advancing beyond. Was that Philippians or Galatians? I was advancing beyond my fellow countrymen. He was climbing the ladder of success in the Jewish system. What did he gain by being a trickster? Read 2 Corinthians 11, see what he gained. Stripes and persecutions and stonings, and that's what he gained. He never used it for personal profit, so why'd he do it? So it wasn't that he went mad. The book of Romans is a good proof of that. It wasn't that he was tricked. There wasn't the possibility of being tricked. It wasn't that he was then doing it to deceive others, because he never did, and he lost everything he had. The only other actual ending is that it really happened just the way he said. And you read in the book of Galatians, chapter 1, Paul uses his conversion as proof that Jesus raised from the dead. So you got, he was mad. Nope. He was deceived. Nope. He was a deceiver. Never did. He saw it. That's the only one that holds water. And so you have his conversion as proof of the resurrection of Jesus. Different proof than the apostles used. We saw him before he went in the grave. We saw him on the cross. We saw him when he went in the grave. And we saw him alive after. That was their testimony. Paul's is, look at my changed life. So, unless you have questions on that. I've got this wonderful class that I teach. Haven't taught it in maybe 20 years. Called the Historical Evidences of Christianity. And it deals with the evidence of the resurrection of Jesus and how that substantiates. If he raised from the dead, the article I put in the bulletin kind of isn't really a, the Reader's Digest version of the Reader's Digest version of the Reader's Digest version of the argument. Okay? But if he raised from the dead, then he's credible. And I can trust what he said. And he said a lot of things about the Bible. And so I could trust the Bible. All right. Final thoughts?